Sheffield Live, made in Sheffield, made by you.
Wake up to something different on Sunday mornings by joining me, Pete Evans, for Spinning Jazz. The finest in modern jazz, from hard bop to bossa nova, from Latin to soul. That's Spinning Jazz every Sunday morning at 9 on Sheffield Live. 93.2 FM.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best in new indie, electro, EDM and punk, and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
Good afternoon, listeners. You are listening to The Film Show on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM and on digital, and you can listen online if you miss the show. I'm Martin, and I'm all on my own. Hello and welcome to another show about film and filmy stuff. Denise isn't here this week. She's off down to London again. This time I think she's going to see Brendan Gleeson in Panto. Now we'll see if she's actually listened to this show, if she makes mention of that when she returns next week. But anyway, she's down there having an overdose of culture. And I'm here trying to scrape a show together. It's been a really strange week trying to put together what on earth to talk about this week. There hasn't been much out in the way of new releases. I haven't seen any interesting gossip, and I haven't watched any trailers either. So unfortunately, I've been left to talk about in some detail two major losses to British film and television industry that have happened this week, and I hope I'm going to give both of them a good tribute. I do have a weird selection of music for later on in the show. But first of all, I'm going to kick off with the death on Thursday, I believe it was, when it was announced, of the British film director Peter Watkins. And he may well not be a name that is very familiar to many of you out there. And Watkins has spent almost the past 60 years or so working on the periphery of the film industry. An iconoclastic rebel who has raged against the establishment and established forms of media production. Watkins started off as an angry young man, quite literally, joining the BBC in 1962, where he was part of the intake that also included such luminaries as Ken Russell and John Schlesinger. And the first thing that he made that brought him to the attention of the world was a sort of mockumentary, if you will, that he made in 1963 called Culloden. And it was a documentary retelling of the Battle of Culloden between the Duke of Cumberland's British soldiers and Scottish Highland clans. And as the film unfolds, you see it was a lot more complicated than that, as lots of the clans were fighting for the English, and the waters were far more muddied about the entire conflict. And I believe I'm right in saying Culloden was the last land battle to be fought on British soil, and this was back in 1745, I believe. The strange thing about the film is it was made in a very specific and, for the time, very unique way. It was shot as if there were television cameras there on the battlefield recording the events and interviewing the soldiers, the Highlanders, innocent bystanders, journalists, as events unfolded. And for the time, this was an extraordinary way of presenting history. It's been done many, many times since, but Watkins was the person who introduced this way of doing it, bringing modern media techniques to look at history. And the other quite extraordinary thing about it is, if you sit and watch it, it's they only used about 30-odd extras to create the battle, and through very careful use of camera work and editing, they give you the sense of this being a major conflict between hundreds of soldiers on each side. So it's an extraordinary piece of work, and it was I think it went out on the play for not the play, I think it might have gone out on the Horizon slot. So whether or not it was being put out as a documentary or a piece of drama, his work has always straddled both of those particular genres. But Culloden had an enormous impact, praised across the board, and due to that he was then given the chance to make a film about the effects of nuclear war, and probably his most famous film resulted from that, 1964's The War Game, which depicted the effect of a nuclear attack on Canterbury. And in a similar way to how Culloden had done this in a newsreel, news reportage fashion, this is exactly how Watkins attacked this particular subject, with interviews with people, charts, graphs, statistics, stage footage of the attack actually happening, and most desperately tragic, the aftermath of the attack and the breakdown of society. Now, the film caused a lot of controversy at the BBC, and the BBC decided not to broadcast it due to the fact that one of the main things in the film was its it showed that the civil defence procedures that were in place for Great Britain were absolutely useless and would have had no effect at all to save anybody's life. Now, the story then went that the BBC were put under pressure from the then Labour government to stop the broadcast. Watkins got into a major argument with the BBC hierarchy about them not broadcasting it, and the film was pretty much put on ice for the next 20 years, certainly as far as television broadcast went. And the film would only be seen at screenings, art house cinemas, or political gatherings of CND. It would be just there for one particular screening and advertised as such. Albeit in 1966, the film won the Academy Award for the Best Documentary of that year. It still didn't reach a wider audience in this country. So there again, as far as the Academy was concerned, it was deemed to be a documentary. Watkins had a very nasty fallout with the BBC, and for the rest of his career, he had to go from pillar to post almost, finding money to allow him to make the sort of films that he wanted to make. And therefore, the amount of films that he actually made is relatively small for the amount of time that he was active and working. He made a feature film after leaving the BBC called Privilege, which was about a pop star being used by a fascist government to keep the people in line and give them some Saturday night entertainment with some pop songs. He then went to America, where he made the film Punishment Park, which is about, and this is very, very in line with what is happening in the States today, where radicals were being arrested off the streets, put into camps, and then given the opportunity to be free if they could do this sort of run of the arrow whilst being chased down by government federal agents across the desert. Again, it's a film which has alarming parallels with what's happening in America today. For the rest of his career, Watkins worked mainly in Scandinavia, and it was there that he made what I think is his most brilliant film, which was a sort of a biography of the painter Edvard Munch. And this is an absolutely extraordinary film. It is on YouTube. And a number of these films I've mentioned are there on YouTube if you want to test the waters. Some of these films can be quite challenging. And Edvard Munch is 3.5 hours. The story of Munch's struggle to do his work, to get his work exhibited. And there are many parallels with how Watkins felt about his life. But it's an intensely beautiful film as well. And I would recommend that. But start off with one of the shorter ones if you haven't seen Culloden. That's probably a good one to start with. But Edvard Munch is, for me, his greatest work. And after that, he embarked on a couple of monumental documentaries. Some of them lasting quite literally 15, 16 hours, which are broken down into hour-long episodes. And his final film was The Commune, a film about the 1871 Paris Commune, which again he filmed as if it was taking place whilst being recorded by 24/7 Rolling News. Watkins is not an easy director. His work, as I say, can be extraordinarily challenging. And he had very, very strong views on how the media worked. He said we were all being fed news and information in something he called the monoform, a way of presenting news in easily digestible chunks to an unquestioning audience. I think I'll leave that with you as that opens up. Yes, a whole lot of discussion. As I say, go onto YouTube, Google Peter Watkins, and you will find there's a wealth of material there that you can dive into. if you feel something a little more a little more than your favourite horror film this weekend. Right, music. I've indulged myself this weekend, and I'm going to be playing a selection of, I hope this isn't offending anyone out there, krautrock. German music from the late 60s and 70s, where some of the best rock music was being made in Germany, or certainly West Germany. And a number of these bands composed music for movies during this time. Some of these movies were being made in West Germany. Some were being made in Britain. And some were even made in Hollywood. So we've got a range of musical styles and three or four bands here that I've delved into. But I'm going to start off with a piece of music by the Elektronische Musik aus Köln. Electronic music from Cologne. And this is a track called Film Music. It was done in the 80s as a sort of pastiche of movie music by this electronic group from Cologne. So here we are with Film Music. Listening to the film show on Sheffield Live and 93.2 FM and on digital, and that was Film Music by the electronic music from Cologne. As I say, I'm trawling through German electronic, well, mostly electronic music from the 60s and 70s, where there was a really vibrant music scene there in the country. In fact, West Germany at that particular time, during those years, we saw the rise of the German New Wave cinema, of directors such as Herzog, Wenders, Roland Klick, making films which were starting to give a completely different view of Germany. Much of the time since the end of the Second World War, German cinema had been producing pretty much standard thrillers, melodramas, westerns, the sauerkraut westerns, which came before the spaghetti westerns. But they were very fairly generic, banal movies, not showing a great deal of panache or imagination in how they were shot. And then all of a sudden, this new group of filmmakers came on the scene and began to really push the boundaries of what German cinema could actually tackle in the way of subject matter and in the way in which that subject matter could be presented on screen. So the next track is, and I'm going to apologise here, that I paid this track a couple of weeks back, but it's like, I can't not play this track. And it's Popol Vuh, and it is the music from Werner Herzog's Aguirre, Wrath of God, which I still think is one of the most transcendent pieces of music. And if you've not seen Aguirre since I told you last time, bad people, you need to watch it. No more horror films for you. Aguirre is a horror film enough. But anyway, this is the theme from Aguirre. Aguirre, from Aguirre, Wrath of God, a great film by Werner Herzog, and that was from Popol Vuh. Okay, moving rather briskly along, the other very sad loss this week was the death of Brunella Scales. I was thinking, we were talking last week about there being a statue of Renée Zellweger in Leicester Square. I think maybe a statue of Brunella Scales might be a little more appropriate. But Scales was working in British stage, screen and TV for 70 years. Woman and girl, as we might say. And I think in some ways, many of us think of her as just one thing, as Sybil Fawlty. But she had a very rich and successful career, which covered many different forms. She was a very, very well-respected stage actress, and she was in a number of quite groundbreaking productions on stage. She was the first person to play Queen Elizabeth II on stage in A Question of Attribution. That was a play which was about Elizabeth. It was written by Alan Bennett, and Bennett playing Anthony Blunt, one of the Cambridge spies. It was a stage version that was put on at the National. And so she was the first person to be on stage doing an interpretation of the Queen. She started acting on stage during the 1950s. You can see her in Hobson's Choice from 1954, a David Lean film. She began working in television. She was very briefly in Coronation Street, where she played a bus conductress for five episodes. During the 60s, she spent most of her time going between stage and television. She was very successful in a number of stage productions. She was also in a television series called Marriage Lines on the BBC, which was a sort of comedy show about, as it says here, the pitfalls of early married life, which her and Richard Briers starred in. Maybe a trial run for The Good Life. But it is 40 Towers, I think, which many of us would immediately think of her as being the defining role of her career. Sybil Fawlty is a character, a force of nature, that many of us would immediately think of, thinking of Brunella Scales. And it's only 12 episodes, two seasons, with which she forged that identity. I was reading something about how that particular character was formed. And John Cleese had imagined Sybil to be far posher, more refined. Scales said, no, she needs to be a couple of notches down the social scale than Basil. And that sets up a very, very interesting dynamic between the two of them, because Basil probably thinks he's married beneath his station, whereas he also knows that Sybil is the one that keeps the hotel going. And in every way possible, he thinks he's superior in intelligence, in aptitude, but Sybil is the rock that keeps that place going. I just think that is that little twist in what the social differences were between them is what really brings out that antagonism and also disappointment. It's like both characters are incredibly disappointed with the choices they've made in life. Sybil thought Basil would be far, far better a choice as husband. Basil thought that Sybil would have been maybe even a trophy wife for him. Sadly, it didn't turn out like that. But the rest is history. Well, I was saying to a friend of mine in the week, I said, don't you always find that there's something very sexy about Cybill Fawlty? And he looked at me aghast. He said, how could you think that? I said, well, I don't know, I've just always thought that. There is something very sexy about Cybill Fawlty. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's why I've made so many bad decisions in life. But that wasn't the end of Scales's fame in British media. I should obviously also point out that she and Timothy West had married back in, I think it was 1953, and they were married for over 60 years, and of course West passed away last November. But Scales was also become a national figure through the 10 years or so she played Dotty, the elderly lady who would shop in Tesco's. And there would be a series of contretemps and things about Tesco's and the way we shop now with Scales and Jane Horrocks playing her daughter. And he's become incredibly popular. She again became a national figure, and it almost overshadowed the Cybill Fawlty persona, and Dotty managed to fight a way out of the shadow of Cybill, shall we call it. As you probably know, Scales was diagnosed with Alzheimer's about 10, 12 years ago, and for their final years, her and West toured around the country and around parts of the world on various canal trips, which I used to find incredibly moving and incredibly happy. They were quite joyous things of watching two people so in love who were looking after each other in the ways that each of them could do so. So that's a sad farewell to Prunella Scales. We will not see her like again, as they say. And it's for me to go back to some music now. The next track is going to be quite raucous, so I don't know if this is going to fit in quite well. But back to the world of krautrock and the music of one of my favourite bands, Can, who made some truly amazing records during their career. And in 1970, they were employed by the Polish director, Jerzy Skolimowski, to write a song for his film Deep End. Deep End is a very, very strange film. Skolimowski, Polish director, made this film set in London, and it starred Jane Asher, John Moulton Brown, a cameo from Diana Dawes, and the exteriors, most of the exteriors were filmed in either Soho or a swimming baths in Leytonstone. And it's about the week in the life of a young school leaver who takes his job as an assistant at a swimming baths, becomes obsessed with a girl who's working there, Susan, played by Jane Asher. And, one thing leads to another. And we sort of, at the almost like the fag end of the swinging 60s, London doesn't look swinging in this. It doesn't. Well, we don't get to see a lot of it anyway, because most of the interiors were filmed in Bavaria. And so there's a strange, sort of almost like a mongrel-like quality to this, with the locations being disparate. Much of the cast are German, dubbed into English. So there's a real sort of sense of disconnect with it. The German band Can, who they sort of, they were a strange combination of jazz, funk, rock, and they were absolutely years ahead of their time, and I think they still are now. And this track I'm going to play is the only piece of music they composed for it. Cat Stevens also wrote a number of songs for the soundtrack. But this song is called Mother Sky, and it follows Mulder Brown as he walks around Soho trying to follow Susan as he's become incredibly obsessed with her. Well, this goes on for a bit, but this is the short version.
Thank you.
Listening to the film show on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM and on digital, and you just listened to Can and Mother Sky from Jerzy Skolimowski's Deep End, a film I thoroughly recommend to you all. You'll never forget Jane Asher's Bright Yellow Mac after you've watched it, and incredibly, that piece of music was recorded 55 years ago. And to me, it still sounds as though it comes from the future. Onwards then, onwards. Films, I didn't go to the pictures this week. There was nothing I fancied going to see. It's a bit of strange, sort of like limbo week, it seems to have been. Nothing, not much has seemed to have happened. But I did catch a documentary on Apple, which has started on there this week. A documentary directed by Ben Stiller, and it's called Stiller and Mira, Nothing is Lost. And it's a documentary about his mother and father, Jerry Stiller and Anne Mira, who were like a comedy team, certainly during the 1960s and into the early 70s on American TV. They were quite popular. And it's about, his mother died in 2015, his father died in 2020, and it's Ben and his sister Amy going back to their apartment in New York and clearing all the stuff out. And it would seem that his father was something of a hoarder as far as photos, letters, film, videos that he had made about all of their lives together. And then he and his sister start to reminisce about what it was like being the children of two quite famous entertainers and the pressures that that put on their parents' lives and on their lives as children. And it's a very affecting and affectionate movie, which I enjoyed enormously. One of the things about it is when Stiller is making this, he is his mother and father's relationship, let's say, could be volatile. They might both be arguing at different times, and the relationship was not always smooth, let's say. Stiller looks back on this and thinks, well, how this reflects his own life as well, of how at the same time he was going through marital problems with his wife. They had separated, and he could see the parallels within his life and his parents' life. There's something about it where you feel maybe the making of this film helped he and his wife get back together again. As I say, I just found that very, 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 very moving. And if you're not that aware, maybe Jerry Stiller is better known in this country, as he was Frank Costanza in Seinfeld, the George Costanza's father with the volcanic temperament. And he also played for many years in King of Queens as well. So he was in a number of well-known television shows. And he's that much more recognisable to you. It's well worth seeing if you've got Apple. It passes an hour and a half quite well, and you just feel like you've learned a little bit about his parents and about his family as it is now. Right, so I'm going to get on now with another piece of music. Something a little more pastoral, I think, and another piece by the group Popol Vuh. And this is again from a Herzog movie, this time Nosferatu. And so this is Popol Vuh and Morning Sun. Morning Sun there by Popol Vuh from Nosferatu. And I'm sorry that I'd lost my notes, and I'm talking about Ben Stiller's wife, of course, is Christine Taylor. I apologise for my lapse in my documentation there. But yeah, Taylor is in the film, and they talk quite extensively about how making the film has led to their a reconciliation, let's say, between them. Okay, next piece of music is from Tangerine Dream, and Tangerine Dream have scored masses of Hollywood movies. And this is the theme music from William Friedkin's Sorcerer, a film which would have been quite good to have covered when we were looking at films that are being rehabilitated a few weeks ago. Seen as a complete and utter disaster when it was released in the late 70s, it is currently now undergoing a severe exercise of rehabilitation, re-evaluation. The story of four desperate men taking two truckloads of Gelignite over an impossible jungle terrain to try and stop a oil fire which is about to engulf an oil field out in the middle of nowhere. This is Sorcerer. Sorry about that. I'm going to... I'll get it back in a moment. Gonna have to put the next disc in. So, God, I knew it'd all go wrong. Getting there. Right. Ready at long last. Apologies for that. Tangerine Dream there, and the theme from Sorcerer. One film that is worth catching this week, which has just started this week, and that's Anne-Marie Jaquier's Palestine 36, a big historical drama about the British rule in Palestine during the 1930s and the onset of much of the troubles and conflicts which are going on in that region now. It's a big-scale historical epic. Jeremy Irons is in it, and it's being considered as being Palestine's entry to the 2026 Academy Awards. And that's on at the Curzon this week. Starting next week, there is that other Predator movie I think we spoke about, Predator Badlands, which seems to be, I don't know, like acclimatising the predator to be a much more nicer creature than what it was in previous outings. There's also, again, as we spoke about, Russell Crowe as Hermann Göring in Nuremberg starts next week. But most interestingly is the new Lynn Ramsey film, Die, My Love, which, if you look at the trailer, visually just looks amazing. I'm sure we will be reviewing that next week and giving you our opinions on it, but it is definitely one to catch next week. Okay, our final piece of music is, again, from Cannes, and this is from some music they composed for a film that the American director Samuel Fuller made for West German television. And the film was called Dead Pigeon on Beethoven Street. And there was a regular West German TV show which gave Fuller the opportunity to make an episode. And he completely rejigged how the normal show would go. He killed off the detective who was in it each week in the first 5 minutes of the film and completely rejigged the whole thing, as you would expect from Fuller, who was another director who never played by the rules. Anyway, he caught up with Cannes, and they put together some music for the film, and here is a part of the suite that they composed for him. Oh, by the way, enjoy your movies. I won't be back after this. I'll be back next week. Enjoy everything, and have a great week. Thank you.